Thank you. Be seated. Justice Gamage had to go to Washington, call the government to his other job with the United States Navy, but he will participate in the deliberation and decision of this case. We're happy to welcome students from Alvin High School here for the argument of Clyde Hurricane Sr. versus Hearst Corporation on certified question for the United States Court of Appeals. The court is ready to hear argument from the amicus curiae appointed by the court on behalf of Mr. King's position, Mr. Joseph Chumley.
May it please the court, this morning, my name is Joe Chumley, and I am appearing today as amicus curiae. The question before the court concerns the dimensions of the right of privacy. Does it include false life portrayals? The right of privacy, as this court is aware, was first announced in Texas in the case of Billings versus Atkinson. And there the court defined the right as including, among other things, the right to be free from unwarranted publicity. Billings was an intrusion into solitude case. It involved a wiretap. But the court did not limit the right of privacy to intrusion or any other of Prosser's four classifications alone. Instead, privacy under that case is a broadly defined right, the purpose of which, as stated therein, is to protect one's sensibilities, one's peace of mind, and to offer redress for mental anguish for unwarranted publicity. What is false light invasion of privacy? Under the ruling by this court recently in the Diamond Shamrock versus Mendez case, we know that it is the malicious false portrayal of an individual in a highly offensive manner that causes mental anguish. That is, deliberately publicizing a falsehood about a person. Now, the opposing briefs, amicus briefs, suggest that this false light branch of right of privacy has little to do with the concept of privacy. I submit that's clearly not the case. As I've said, under Billings, the right includes the freedom from unwarranted publicity, offering protection to peace of mind. What could be more unwarranted or more invasive of one's peace of mind than to be cast falsely before the public in a false light? And I submit that this conduct is no less invasive or damaging to the sensibilities than an intrusion into one's solitude or to have private embarrassing facts disclosed or made public. As this court is aware, approximately 3 years after the Billings decision, the court also recognized that that disclosure of private embarrassing facts is an invasion of the right of privacy in the Industrial Foundation versus Texas IAB case. Therefore, liability attaches or may attach to the publication of truthful, albeit embarrassing, private facts if it causes mental anguish. Consider the...
Why would not libel take care of any harm done to your client?
To Mr. King?
Yes. I understand it's not your client. I appreciate the efforts that you're making on behalf of the court in this difficult question, but it's difficult for me to understand how a man with such a long rap sheet, 36 arrests, convicted felon, convicted of murder, asserts that he was somehow harmed by an article that said that he was a member of the Dixie Mafia.
Sure. Clearly.
So my question is, why is it not liable, perhaps a viable tort for him to seek redress?
It may very well be. And clearly, many invasions of privacy falling into the false light branch will also constitute libel or slander. However, and this is the point I've tried to demonstrate in my brief, the question here is a broad question. Does Texas recognize false light? If we say it does not, we jeopardize, we run the risk of placing individuals who will not have a cause of action for libel or slander, but yet who are nevertheless damaged by being cast falsely before the public and suffer mental anguish of having no redress whatsoever.
Opposing counsel contends that you failed to think of a single example where somebody fell into that situation.
I think you disagree. I do, and I guess the challenge is to the examples that I have submitted in my brief, and I think this demonstrates the difference between libel and false light. The suggestion, I think, by opposing briefs is not that my examples are not false light, but that they could be libel and slander. I submit that none of the examples I have given constitute defamation per se. They are not defamatory on their face. And under Texas law, then, in order to be defamatory, the plaintiff would have to show special damages, injury to reputation. And I think all the opposing briefs are saying is, in most of those instances in my examples, that might be shown. And I concede that. That is absolutely true. My point is, it might also not be shown. It might be that the only injury suffered was mental anguish, the type of injury that the Billings tort is designed to offer redress for. Certainly, you can take perhaps any false light portrayal, and if you can show that it injured the plaintiff in his or her community, then you have a libel or slander.
Almost any libel could be categorized as false light. If it was bad enough to be called libel, it could be a defamation that would be come under the definition of false light too, couldn't it?
Most invasions of privacy will be libel. Most libels will be invasions of privacy, but not necessarily.
Not necessarily. But anything that is truly libelous could also be a defamation, and could be considered false light if it is advertised in that way.
That's true, Your Honor. But
wouldn't this situation be truly analogous to the Finkley versus Jacksonville Daily Progress, where we had a man in the penitentiary in the same kind of situation, and there the issue was libel.
I'm not familiar with the exact holding. I don't know whether that was a libel-proof.
Libel-proof.
Holding, and I submit that's truly not the issue here. Libel-proof, I don't believe, has ever been upheld by this court as a defense to libel. I think it's been addressed by some courts of appeals.
But couldn't you be defamation-proof? Couldn't you be challenge that you might make on some individual as to their character? Couldn't there be defamation proof?
The concept being that somebody's reputation is so bad that it cannot be further damaged.
That's right.
And to the extent that a career criminal falls into that category, that defense might be someday upheld by this court. I don't think that's the issue today, however. If it is, it might also be a defense or be evidence with respect to whether the plaintiff could actually have suffered any mental anguish. The duplication argument, I think, raised is whether or not somebody with a libel case also has an invasion of privacy case. Admittedly, there is a substantial overlap.
Well, let me be clear about that. Can you think of a case that would fall under defamation, where you could recover under defamation, but you could not recover under false light?
Only if the evidence did not support or prove mental anguish. Because false light...
Right. That would be the only term.
Coming back
the other way, you can think, or at least you argue that you can think of false light cases that would not be proof of defamation, and I think probably there are many such examples. Why then would anybody not bring a false light case every time they brought a defamation case isn't the acknowledgement of that tort just an extension of the bounds of defamation?
Only to the extent that if you suffered mental anguish damages and you're within the limitations period, a good lawyer clearly would want to plead as many applicable torts or causes of action. Just for example, as I pointed out in my brief, if you had a good fraud case, you'd want to attach a DTPA case to it. Or if you had a debt collection act that involved numerous phone calls, you might have an intrusion into solitude privacy case. The answer is yes, but I don't think that calls for eliminating the tort or not recognizing it, because there will be instances where there is no defamation, and that's where my focus is.
But my question to you is this. If then false light really effectively extends the boundaries of defamation, and defamation has been circumscribed to balance the rights of speech versus the right of privacy or the right not to be defamed, this is striking a new balance.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I don't think false light extends the bounds of libel or slander or defamation. It is an aspect of libel or slander or defamation. In a libel case, you can recover for mental anguish damages without resorting to the privacy tort. However, there are primary differences, and the examples I give are pure examples. But where there is only mental anguish damage, there's no extension of the defamation tort whatsoever. There merely is proof of the false publication, the maliciousness, the knowing element, and proof of mental anguish damages. That is not, if there's no proof of injury to reputation, then you don't have a defamation case. And I would.
But you have liability for what was said. Wouldn't have it otherwise.
You have liability for liability that compensates for the mental anguish damages that you do have, I submit, under the Billings Tort. And I think we have to look to the Billings Tort. What did this court do in 1973? It didn't say we now recognize 1, 2, and 3 of Prosser's classifications. It could have done that. Instead, it granted a cause of action for a violation of the right of privacy and defined it broadly. And as I said to begin with, we've got to consider, this court has to consider, what are the dimensions of that. Consider having already recognized the cause of action for disclosure of private embarrassing facts. Consider the anomaly. Assume that Mr. Jones discloses in a group that Mrs. Smith had an abortion when she was 16 years old. And assume that that's a true statement. Mr. Jones is not intending to harm Mrs. Smith. He's just not thinking about the consequences of his comment. If she suffers extreme mental anguish, there's liability for disclosure of private embarrassing facts. But consider now that instead of it being true, that the statement is false. The conduct, and Mr. Jones knows that it's false. The damage is the same. Assume that it causes no injury to Mrs. Smith's reputation. But the damage is the same. The conduct actually is worse.
Counsel, you're here this morning as an amicus at the request of the court and not as an attorney for Mr. Kane.
Yes, sir.
You never talked to Mr. Kane.
I don't know Mr. Kane.
And he will lose his claim just as surely under the statute if he fails on the statute of limitations issue as if he loses on the false license issue.
Absolutely. The Billings tort covers mental injury caused by innocent revealing of facts as well as the deliberate lie, and the plaintiff is going to have to qualify under the tort if he or she has no mental anguish. If he or she has not brought the case within the applicable statute of limitations, the case will survive or fall on those grounds. Consider further, and this goes to the duplication argument, that Texas law already permits the same false light recovery in the context of economic loss for businesses. This is the injurious falsehood or business disparagement tort available in addition to libel and slander, I might add. This court considered the viability of that cause of action in the Hurlbut versus Gulf Atlantic case. The elements of injurious falsehood applicable to businesses are identical to false light, but for the damage issue.
Could you expand on that?
Yes, ma'am. The business disparagement tort has essentially three elements: false disparaging words, malice, and lack of privilege. It focuses its damages on economic loss. False light has the exact same elements, but for the damage issue, it focuses on mental anguish. False light is false, highly offensive words, malice, and lack of privilege. And in the Hurlbut versus Gulf Atlantic case, the same challenge was made. This is simply a duplication of the defamation tort. And this court disposed of that argument by noting the different interests protected by the two torts. Defamation, on the one hand, protects injury to reputation, your standing in the community, whereas injurious falsehood or business disparagement protects economic loss. False light, on the other hand, protects the interest this court found deserving of protection in Billings: mental anguish, injury to the person.
Family, let me ask you, on false light, there seems to me there's one other aspect of false light that we haven't touched on, and that is where everything that is reported is true, but it's reported in such a manner as to cast a false conclusion for the reader. It is the identification that an individual committed a certain act, and within the same publication, identifying that certain acts are illegal. There's no connection from one paragraph to the other that the act committed by this person is one of those acts. But it is obvious from the purpose of the article to raise the implication that this happened in this case. That could be a false light, it seems to me, if that's recognized here. That could create a cause of action for false light, even though everything that's reported is entirely true. It's sort of it's accurate but not true statement, because the obvious purpose of the article is to raise the issue and identify an individual, but the article itself does not accuse the individual of doing anything inappropriate. Wouldn't that encompass a false light as opposed to defamation or libel?
The concept of innuendo, I guess, exists in defamation law. I'm aware of cases that hold that even though the printed material actually is true, nevertheless, the implication, the innuendo suggested by a fair reading of it is false. That concept exists in defamation. I have not thought that out in terms of application to false light. I'm a little troubled by it, because in defamation, outside of individual versus the media, truth is a defense, whereas falsity is not the burden on the plaintiff. That's not the case under a false light tort, and it may very well be, as the tort develops, that when those facts are presented, it is an insurmountable burden on the plaintiff to prove that the words spoken were false, whether or not it would cover the innuendo. Obviously, you could borrow from defamation law and say that it does. Whether or not it does, technically, if you look at the definition under the restatement, falsity must be proved by the plaintiff, and in fact that's a distinction with defamation that this court recognized in supporting the injurious falsehood tort.
Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
In court,
may it please the court. My name is Bill Ogden. Together with Stacy Beasley, we represent the Houston Chronicle Publishing Company, Appalee. The question certified from the Fifth Circuit asks whether this court will recognize false light privacy, which is defined in the restatement as liability for knowingly or recklessly placing another in a false light in the public eye in a manner highly offensive to a reasonable person. We ask the court answer the question in the negative and declare unambiguously that false light is not one of the privacy rights recognized in the Billings versus Atkinson tort. Ending the uncertainty occasioned by this court's 1992 decision in Diamond Shamrock versus Mendez. Alternatively, we ask that the court not create a tort as far-reaching as false light on a record as sparse as that of this appellant, Clyde Kane. Mr. Kane's case, it seems to me, is clear as any, indicates the superfluity of false light and also indicates its abuse in being used to circumvent traditional libel defenses. Here, both the statute of limitations and the libel proof doctrine, which has been recognized in Finkley versus Jacksonville Daily Progress. The record does merit a brief reference. Clyde Kane is serving a life term for murder. The Chronicle reported on his conviction in its June 30, 1991 newspaper. 18 months later, he sued, claiming that the reference in the article to a prosecutor who referred to him as the last known member of the Dixie Mafia placed him in a false light in the public eye. It is, to me, significant to note those statements in the article about which Mr. Kane made no complaint. The article refers to Kane as a burglar, thief, pimp, and killer whose notoriety stretches from Texas to Georgia. The article says Kane killed his lawyer in 1973 and married his widow 4 months later. It says he killed a 67-year-old man in 1977 who died in the arms of his wounded wife. The article says
I don't believe we're here on the merits of the case, and I wish you'd direct your argument to the problem of free speech as opposed to the tort that is sought.
I will, Your Honor. I emphasize the points in the article which are not challenged because I think it indicates the reason why false light is a problem. It adds nothing to the existing law of libel. It hinders judicial efficiency by promoting bad cases, by circumventing libel defenses, and it does raise constitutional issues, which I do want to address.
Is it recognized in a number of other states?
It's recognized, it has been given lip service in a number of jurisdictions. It has been recognized in approximately, I think, 22 jurisdictions.
You disagree with Rodney Smola's conclusion that I referenced in my writing in the Diamond Shamrock case, that false light invasion of privacy actions serve state interest in deterring the publication of damaging false information and protecting reputation?
I think that interest is well served already in the existing law of libel and the other privacy torts. The concern raised in your dissent specifically, which I thought was well placed, is a concern that this is an assault on the general other rights of privacy. I think it's important to realize that in the privacy law, we've got two branches. We've got constitutional rights of privacy, which protect the citizen from intrusion by the government. Rights of autonomy, like to be free in decisions respecting our person, Roe versus Wade. Disclosure of privacy, the right to control government abuse of information, industrial foundation. Those constitutional questions are not at issue in this case. They're not affected here.
They weren't at issue in Mendez either, were they?
No. The tort of privacy was defined in this court, as Mr. Chumley said, in this court's opinion in Billings versus Atkinson. And I wish to draw the court's very careful attention to the Billings case, because three of the four common law privacy torts are well recognized and are established in the common law, and were so before Dean Prosser invented the term false light in his 1960 Law Review article. Intimacy, the public disclosure of embarrassing private facts, such as a surreptitious videotaping of sex in Boyles versus Kerr. That's privacy. Intrusion, like the intentional and offensive intrusion into one's solitude, residential picketing in Valenzuela versus Aquino, or residential wiretap like Billings versus Atkinson. That's a privacy tort. Misappropriation of name or likeness, like the false utilization of an athlete's name as an endorsement for Coca-Cola in the Kimbrough versus Coca-Cola case. These are recognized and well-established rights of privacy. Significantly, these are the three privacy torts which were utilized by this court in defining the privacy right in Billings versus Atkinson. And I'll quote the definition in that case. A judicially approved definition of the right of privacy is that it is the right to be free from the unwarranted appropriation or exploitation of one's personality, misappropriation, the publicizing of one's private affairs with which the public has no legitimate concern, intimacy, or the wrongful intrusion into one's private activities in such a manner as to outrage or cause mental suffering, shame, or humiliation to a person of ordinary sensibilities. That's intrusion. Period. End of sentence. End of paragraph. Prosser's invention of false light privacy is conspicuously absent in this court's own seminal definition of the privacy tort. Now, why do I say that false light is unnecessary? I'm going to return in a minute to the constitutional implications, because as the questions have already brought out, I think it's critical to note that this is a tort implicating speech, and it's a tort that specifically targets media defendants. But let me first focus on what I think are the three types of examples of the cases offered by false light proponents to show how they in fact fit better existing, better defined tort remedies, and why false light is completely unnecessary to the resolution of those types of cases. The three best types of cases the false light proponents have are what I call juxtaposition cases, dramatization cases, or false attribution cases. Juxtaposition is the false or misleading association of someone's photograph with misleading text, like Covington versus Houston Post, where the article concerned the conviction of a bad Margaret Covington, but the photograph that accompanied the article was a good Margaret Covington. Like this case, Covington brought suit after the one-year statute of limitations for libel, but argued that her case should be recognized under the two-year statute, which she claimed applicable to false light. Professor Kelso, in his article cited in the brief, treats all these juxtaposition cases as misappropriation cases. They are the unauthorized exploitation of a name or likeness. And the publisher has no newsworthiness defense to that misappropriation, because the picture of the good Margaret Covington has no bearing at all on the article about the bad Margaret Covington. They can be misappropriation cases if you read the restatement literally. To me, that can also be a pure and simple libel case. That's why Covington brought that case that way initially. It's libel in other jurisdictions, it's treated as libel by implication. If you put a good Margaret Covington's picture next to an article about a Margaret Covington who's convicted, that's tantamount to calling that person a criminal.
Suppose that Margaret Covington is a public figure.
Then under the law of libel, she'd have to prove malice. And under this court's formulation of false light, she'd also have to prove malice. Again, no change. The second class of cases put forward by false light proponents are what I call dramatization, Time versus Hill, the U.S. Supreme Court case concerning the novel and the Broadway play called The Desperate Hours, which was based part upon the true life experience of the Hill family of Philadelphia held captive for 19 hours by escaped convicts. The play includes fictionalized accounts of violence against the family. In real life, the convicts were not violent. And it includes fictionalized acts of heroism of the hostage father.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm going back to the, when I asked if Margaret Covington was a public figure, and said, well, then you just have to have malice. If you're a public figure, can you have an appropriation of a likeness?
I believe a public figure could have an appropriation of name or likeness. An example in the restatement for the misappropriation tort is if someone sets up some type of retail outlet and appropriates the president's name and says this is the Bill Clinton Insurance Agency. That's a misappropriation of the likeness or name of the public.
But a newspaper, just you've got a public official, and the newspaper puts it up there, there's a public official's newsworthy. You can put them all over the newspaper you want to. The question becomes, if you happen to put that picture with another article that has to do with a different Covington, and it's, you're not reporting false information at all. It's all true. Would that not be a false light issue, which may have malice or not, but not an appropriations issue?
It seems to me that any misuse of name or likeness is more properly first addressed under the misappropriation branch of privacy law. If the misappropriation of name or likeness is in the context of a commercial use or a false endorsement or a false attribution, it's pure misappropriation. If the misuse of the name or likeness is in the context of reported news, and it's such that it conveys a false statement of fact to the reasonable reader, it's libel. Either way, it seems to me, you've got an existing remedy under the misappropriation branch of privacy law for the better established bounds of libel law.
Under an implication, just...
Correct. And of course, outside
the statement, if the impression left from the article is false.
Which could be a question of fact. But courts outside this jurisdiction have treated these cases in precisely that way, as libel by implication, that given the modern context of, for instance, news reporting, both broadcast and print, the association of images or pictures juxtaposed with text is meant to convey to the audience that this is the subject matter of the article, or this is the subject matter of the broadcast. And it's not... I don't think an impermissible leap of faith to make the assumption that that's the subject matter of this article, so that's the person we're talking about. Professor Kelso also points out that the dramatization cases that false life proponents overlook, that they were in fact resolved under the misappropriation statute, New York's misappropriation statute. I need to get to the third category of false life cases because these are almost all of these are the ones that are cited in Mr. Chumley's brief at beginning of page 17. His examples of the false attribution of beliefs to a plaintiff, for instance, the false testimonial or attribution that perhaps a pro-life minister is in fact a member of Planned Parenthood or supports abortion on demand. These cases, false attribution cases, are situations like Hinnish versus Meyer and Frank, which is cited in the appellant's brief and cited also in Billings versus Atkinson. Hinnish involved the unauthorized political endorsement, the false attribution of the plaintiff's name to a political endorsement sent in a telegram, I believe, to the Oregon governor without his consent. The most direct way to treat these cases is pure and simple misappropriation tort, as defined in Section 652C of the Restatement. It's the misuse of a person's name for beliefs or attributes they do not endorse. And the reason why false light proponents balk at this is that they assume that misappropriation requires as an element a commercial use or a pecuniary benefit. That was the case in Kimbrough versus Coca-Cola, where the athlete's name was used to endorse the Coca-Cola product. But if you look at the restatement, the language in the restatement itself, it expressly does not require a commercial use. Comment B to Section 652C of the restatement, dealing with misappropriation branch of privacy, reads as follows. The rule stated is not limited to commercial appropriation. It applies also when the defendant makes use of the plaintiff's name or likeness for his own purposes and benefit, even though the use is not a commercial one, and even though the benefit sought to be obtained is not a pecuniary one. Thus, an offensive political, religious, or moral belief may be falsely attributed to someone, and that is a commercial misappropriation. Now, again, if it is reported or used in the sense of an endorsement, like the Hinnish case, a telegram to the governor, that's a pure misappropriation. If the false belief is reported as news that the pro-life minister, in fact, supports abortion on demand, that can, in fact, be libel. It can be defamatory. There's such a thing recognized in the libel law as a defamatory impact that reaches an appreciable segment of the plaintiff's peer group. And while to some of us, perhaps, the attribution of pro-life or pro-choice beliefs may or may not be offensive, it is possible, and there's recognition in the libel law, to treat false attribution reported as a statement of fact as potentially defamatory. Despite the fact, so I do believe that every case that's been raised as a potential false light example is already completely covered by a pre-existing tort better established in the common law. Despite the fact that false light claims are superfluous, and for that point, I commit the court's attention the law review article cited in the brief of Professor Kelso in the Santa Clara Law Review, It's a survey, very exhaustive survey, of over 300 false light cases. And to my mind, a more thorough analysis than that of Prosser, and a very good exposition of the theories available to the plaintiffs in those cases. But to return to the constitutional issue, it does bear emphasis, as courts and commentators have noted, that false light does raise serious constitutional concerns, requiring the court to balance the plaintiff's interest or alleged interest in privacy or reputation against the defendant's rights of free speech and expression. What I want to emphasize is...
How can it raise those questions if it really adds nothing to libel?
Well, what I mean to say is its existence raises those questions. I think it raises the questions because it purports to soften the standard for imposing liability beyond the bounds of defamation.
So there are cases that you could recover for false light that you couldn't recover for libel.
I don't personally believe so, but this would be one if the court adopts the tort, because it circumvents both constitutional issues and statutory defenses if, as the Court of Appeals did in Covington and Clark versus Denton Publishing Company, if the court applies the two-year statute of limitations rather than the one-year statute of limitations.
Well, assuming the one-year statute applied, if false light is coextensive with libel, then there's no harm in recognizing.
There is no constitutional harm if you're clear that the constitutional parameters are the same. My concern is, in most expositions of the tort, it's not clear that the constitutional parameters are the same. I'll give you one specific example. And that is the requirement of publicity. As this court wrote in Industrial Foundation of the South at page 683 of that opinion, it is generally agreed that the publicity requirement of this tort, this tort was the intimacy branch of privacy, not false light, but the language publicity in the restatement is used the same. The publicity requirement is not synonymous with the publication requirement of the law of defamation, wherein publication to one other is sufficient to constitute defamation. Publicity requires communication to more than a small group of persons. The matter must be communicated to the public at large such that the matter becomes one of public knowledge. The same rule was applied in two of the Court of Appeals opinions discussing the false light tort, Wilhite versus HEB and Reeves versus Western Company.
Mr. Ogden, in the Fifth Circuit, urge that the one-year statute of limitations applies here.
Correct.
And if it does apply, Mr. Kane, with all of his antisocial behavior, loses every bit as completely as if we accept your argument that there's no false light cause of action.
Correct. But the potential likelihood for other claimants to attempt to impose liability on the false light theory for speech that is not defamatory, not intrusive, and not an invasion of intimacy, is then given recognition. And that's why I made the point about the facts in this record and the sparseness of this record. As Professor Zimmerman noted in her article, which was quoted in Justice Gonzalez's dissent, the sheer breadth of the privacy tort exposes a much wider range of errors to liability than does defamation. The inevitable result is a sharp increase in the potential chilling effect of false light. So there are literally thousands of journalists, broadcasters, authors, employers, whose cases and briefs and facts are not before you here. And the court would be, if it gives credence to this tort, recognizing a potential exposure on a constitutionally vague standard for thousands of cases that are not briefed here, that are not present here, on the mere speculation, on the hypothetical hunch that there someday in the future could be a case that is not defamatory, not intrusive, and not invasive, but yet would fit the false light formula. I don't think that's a warranted extension of the common law in this case and on this record.
My confusion is that you seem to argue on the one hand that there's not a case that we can think of that could be brought under false light that could not also be brought under defamation law. And on the other hand, if false light were adopted, it would so greatly expand the potential liability that it would threaten even constitutional rights. those arguments seem to conflict.
Well, I think the answer is in the question you asked during the first presentation, and that is that since the form, if there really is nothing in false life that's not covered in other torts, why then are we permitting plaintiffs to tag it along to libel cases and adopt a different semantic formulation of liability? And that's where Professor Zimmerman's concern, I think, is apropos. If you substitute for defamatory the standard of highly offensive to a reasonable person, what difference have you made? I don't think there's a true case that fits in the difference, but there is the potential that the highly offensive language could be construed in a broader, more nebulous, less defined type of reach that could have a chilling effect.
Maybe I've missed something, but isn't there significance to the damages in defamation and libel? Your damages are your harm to your reputation. That is how you are perceived by others. And under false light, it's how you, as being the subject of the article, is offended by the article. In the significance of false light, that I don't have to prove the hurt to my reputation, I just have to prove the hurt to me.
To me, that's a distinction without a difference. As the U.S. Supreme Court said in Zucchini versus Scripps Howard, the interest protected by false light, quoting Prosser, is clearly that of reputation with the same overtones of mental distress as in defamation. If you look at this court's opinion in Levendecker and Associates versus Wechter at 683 Southwest 2nd 369, and the Fifth Circuit's opinion in Braun versus Splint, it is clear that under both court doctrines, mental anguish can be recovered under both. Injury to reputation can be covered under both. This court has sanctioned mental anguish awards in defamation and libel cases.
Without a finding of damage to reputation.
I don't know of one that involves no evidence of a damage to reputation, but on the facts of Braun versus Splint in the Fifth Circuit, the Fifth Circuit wrote, we can't tell the difference. All that this plaintiff talked about was her great distress and her hurt feelings and one conversation in a convenience store. It doesn't appear to be injury to reputation, but it doesn't matter. The injury is the same.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kevin.
I think Justice Enoch's comment demonstrates what the difference is. If you look at the statutory definition of a libel, it requires injury to reputation in the community. You examine what is the community effect based on the word's import. And courts have recognized that words may be false, abusive, and unpleasant, and yet not be defamatory. That's the language in the Rawlins versus McKee case cited in my brief. Contrast that with the interest that Billings does protect. It does protect the subjective sensibilities of the person, which is demonstrated by what Justice Enoch was just saying. You can have cases where there is no damage to the person's reputation generally. Let's take the false statement about the person having had an abortion when she was 16 years old. That may actually increase the person's reputation in the community for some strange reason. Maybe not so strange, but it nevertheless could cause extreme humiliation and personal outrage on the part of the person. That comment is not defamatory per se. Therefore, to constitute libel, the plaintiff would have to show special damages. And if she can't show that, she's out. She does not recover for her mental anguish unless there is false light. Mr. Ogden discusses, well, all of these cases are going to come under the appropriation tort. I don't think that's clear at all. I submit that the cases defining appropriation and applying Texas law do seem to indicate that there must be some commercial purpose in the appropriation of the name or likeness. Certainly that was the situation in the Kimbrough case. where there is no advantage gained by the plaintiff, and there's only mental anguish suffered by the, I'm sorry, where there's no advantage gained by the defendant and there's only mental anguish suffered by the plaintiff, I submit you do not have an appropriation case in Texas. And unless you can show special damages showing injury to reputation in the community, you're left without any redress whatsoever, despite the definition that Mr. Ogden read in the Billings case about what is the right of privacy. What he didn't read was the sentence just before what he did read, which says the right of privacy is the right to be free from unwarranted publicity. The constitutional issues I'll address just briefly. I submit that these are procedural issues mentioned in Justice Gonzalez's dissent in the Mendez case, and I've attempted to respond to that in my brief by suggesting that really there are only three criticisms here with regard to alleged procedural protections that will be lost in false light, and I submit that they will not be lost because of the requirement in Mendez that actual malice be proved. These three protections are qualified privileges, absolute privileges, which are really immunities, and retraction. There were two others, one having to do with the jurisdiction, I think, of constitutional county courts, and another one having to do with a rule procedure where the damages don't exceed $20. Admittedly, they won't apply. But with regard to the other three, there is no diminishing of a procedural protection with regard to conditional or qualified privileges. All of the qualified privileges which exist at common law and in statutory libel in Texas are defeated when actual malice is proved. Since actual malice is an element of false light, there's nothing lost with regard to that aspect. Absolute privileges. These are the immunities with regard to speech conducted in judicial proceedings, quasi-judicial proceedings, official proceedings, those types of proceedings. I think there are four mentioned in my brief. Those will apply equally to false light. The restatement, 625F, I believe, says that all of the absolute privileges existing with respect to defamation law apply equally with respect to false light. And the reason is those immunities, those absolute privileges, are rooted in a public policy that is exalted over any individual harm that may result because of the words that are uttered. This court in the Hurlbut case, when it recognized injurious falsehood for businesses, recognized in the concluding page, I think, that those absolute privileges would apply equally with respect to that tort. There's no reason to suggest that they wouldn't equally apply with respect to the false light tort. I go back to making sense of the law in this area. How does one reconcile recognizing business disparagement, which is nothing more than false light for businesses, and not recognizing false light for individuals when the harm is the very harm that the Billings Court was designed to protect, mental anguish? How does one reconcile recognizing the private disclosure of private embarrassing facts, that is, liability for saying something that's true that just happens to be intrusive because it's embarrassing and private, and not imposing liability for something that's false that also causes embarrassment and mental outrage? How do you reconcile that? And finally, how does one reconcile recognizing appropriation, granting economic protection for a name or likeness, but not damages to the sensibilities?
Are you saying in Hurlbut, business disparagement, the measure of damages is the mental anguish the business figure?
No. The only thing it recognized as damages was economic loss. I'm saying that mental anguish is what Billings...
Business disparagement is closer to defamation of an institution.
I submit it is actually the same, because if you look at the definition of libel, it includes words that cause financial injury. That's all that business disparagement is, but yet this court distinguished business disparagement from defamation in Hurlbut. My time is up. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you. That concludes the argument in this morning's causes. They are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will please adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise.
Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh,